title of my book we wrote almost more than a decade ago was The $3 Trillion War, pointing out the high cost of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. We knew that our numbers were conservative, but as time mounted on and the cost mounted up, what we've discovered is that the cost just of caring for our
retreat, we have 20 seconds,
is in the trillions of dollars. The wars have been little benefit, but an enormous cost to our society.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Joe Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, Columbia University professor, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Among his books, People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
And good morning, everybody. We are carrying it on here at KBOO Community Radio, getting ready for our fall pledge drive, membership drive, starting next week. I hope you all are prepared for that. KBOO.fm is our website where you can go and you can contribute right now and cut it short. Anyway, I'm here with my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who is a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and also her dad is a Yankton Dakota, and she is a local writer and activist and co-founder of Eradicating Native Masketry, Offensive Native Masketry, and the author of the recent book Standoff, about the very different standoffs at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and Standing Rock. And good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
So, are we ever going to get some rain around here again?
I guess. I hope so.
We all do. It's old, and there's so much rain some other parts of the country. It's very discombobulating, I must say. Anyway, we persevere, carry it on, as Buffy St. Marie so eloquently says. So we got a bunch of stuff. This is the second Wednesday where you and I discuss issues of relevance to Indian country, to Native Americans, important issues, important events, important personalities. And you've got I hear you're working on a new article about the proposed appointment of Chuck Sams, our local Northwest Umatilla, to the head of the National Park Service, following up on Deb Haaland's position as Interior Secretary.
Yes, yeah, it's really exciting. You know, it happened last month, and the Biden administration announced that they were going to nominate Chuck Sams, a local, Oregon tribal leader from the Umatilla, Confederated Tribes of Umatilla. And And so I've been interviewing a lot of folks about it, and everyone's really excited. He's not a Beltway native insider. He's someone who's worked directly in the communities and particularly worked on, you know, land restoration. And so really bringing that sort of tribally based perspective and experience to a national office. And so people are really excited. You know, Native people, Native nations have been really, in, you know, the last, 50 years or so, have really taken indigenous sovereignty by the horns and really began working on getting land back, right, through the process, which actually is overseen by the Secretary of the Interior, who is now also a Native appointee. She's a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico and also a former congresswoman from New Mexico. And so she's overseeing, you know, vast areas of the United States and even dams and many other sites. And so she also oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs and as well as the National Park Service. And so she will be his boss. But she also has the ability as the Interior Secretary to put land into trust, the tribe. And this is a process that was developed under the Indian Reorganization Act to basically allow tribes to regain land that had been lost, and by the process of manifest destiny and colonization and occupation, they developed this process. So the Secretary of the Interior has power to do this. It has been thrown into some doubt with a decision that was actually authored by Clarence Thomas called a little over 10 years ago, that basically where he stated that the Secretary of the Interior does not have the right to put land in a trust for tribes that were not federally recognized when the Indian Organization was passed back in the 1930s. And so this has been a really problematic decision. But she does have the power. She has quite extensive powers to take land and basically put in a trust for tribes, and this allows the tribes to have jurisdiction and development and the right to make sure the land is preserved. And so, so it's a pretty amazing set of powers that that Native people are beginning to have over vast areas of the United States. And so my article is sort of drawing inspiration from a recent article written by David Troyer, an Ojibwe writer and historian, who wrote a cover article for the Atlantic Monthly recently. And in that article, he proposes, and I think this article came out before the nomination of Chuck Sams was announced, but he proposes that the National Park Service be turned over to a consortium of tribes to run, right, and to utilize this knowledge that tribes have been using, a traditional knowledge based in, you know, long practices to caretake for land, their own homelands, and also to just bring a completely different perspective to them. Management of the national parks. The National Parks, of course, Park Service has struggled with diversity initiatives, bringing in not only a more diverse open the parks up to bring in more people of color to visit the parks and monuments, but also to hire to diversify their staff, and they haven't been very successful in doing this. There has been some criticism about Chuck Sams' nomination, particularly coming from Republicans. There's a retired court justice from North Carolina who's been very outspoken, and he claims that that Chuck Sams doesn't have any experience managing a national park, and so why should he be considered, you know, for the top job? And I heard from some actual National Park Service employees that also made complaints and comments about articles and stuff. And You know, but of course, if you have an institution that is so white and is making so little progress in changing that, it could be decades before we have any person of color who has headed up a national park and run it for any substantial length of time. But and I think that the issue often is structural, right? It's difficult to change the dynamics of agencies and institutions that were established, under sort of the, deeply influenced and during a time of sort of completely unacknowledged white supremacy, right, or fully embraced white supremacy. And it's been very difficult to change those institutions, as we've seen with the efforts to, change the policing in this country. Sometimes institutions are quite resistant to change.
The Republican pushback is obviously inevitable. Just one little note is the idea that Republicans themselves haven't repeatedly appointed people not just with no experience in the agencies that they've headed, but actually antagonistic towards those agencies themselves, which certainly can't be said about Chuck Sams. So that's one little thing. I also want to go back to what you said about the David Troyer article. That's a bold proposal of turning them over. And I just want to get maybe your comment on the history of the establishment of the national parks, a number of which. Well, all of which were obviously created on land that was originally, or even still, as it was, as they were established, either formally or people formally owned by Native tribes, or were people were continuing to live there. I guess the Smoky Mountains National Park was one where there were people who were kicked out of there, and there are a number of others. So that the history itself is somewhat problematic.
Yeah, in the article, he actually gives quite a moving account of Yellowstone National Park is the oldest national park, and it was actually established by Ulysses S. Grant, President Ulysses S. Grant, in 1872. And, just 5 years later in 1877, the Indian Wars were still ongoing, were still happening. And you have Chief Joseph and his people fleeing from the Wallowa Valley here in Oregon, fleeing, demands to sort of hand themselves over and be put on reservations. And there the constant fear of assault and attack by the U.S., by soldiers and also by settlers, they were fleeing to join Sitting Bull's band in Canada, right? And rather than just leave them alone, the U.S. Army was dogging them the entire way, and it did come to a head in Yellowstone, actually, the actual Yellowstone National Park, while it was already established. It was 5 years old at that point. And there were tourists there, white tourists there, in the midst of all of this happening of, basically international war crimes happening right before them. And so it's he actually calls Yellowstone a national crime scene, right? And this is a really different framing than what we generally think about it, as national parks is being, Wallace Stegner is always quoted, the Western historian and writer, Western historian and writer, that it was national parks are America's one great idea, good idea. And so it's quite the sort of idea that it changes the perspective and the framing of national parks substantially. And of course, Chuck Sams here in Oregon has actually worked with to help return land to Chief Joseph's people there in the Wallowa Valley, the return of the ranch, and so he's worked substantively on these issues with tribes, so it's quite interesting to see. And I was looking at a a really great blog, a wildlife photographer. He's on Twitter at Trail Posse, Glenn Nelson. He actually traced that trail this summer in July, went to the Nez Perce Trail of the flight to Canada, and he found that there's several national park and monument sites, particularly battle sites, where women were slaughtered, and where they also fought back successfully against to allow women and children to flee against the U.S. Army. And he found that the trails were not well marked, the battlefields were not well marked, and so these are things where, you know, that history is not being honored. And of course, the National Park Service in general has a huge backlog, like billions of dollars, several billions of dollars backlog in infrastructure costs and delayed improvements to trails and buildings and many other sites. And so it's not been well funded, adequately funded by the federal government. And not having, during the entire Trump administration, not having an actual director under the Trump administration certainly, I think, impacted. And of course, COVID and and the management issues that proposed, you know, with people going up to the trails in large numbers and there not being enough the ability to adequately clean up after them, particularly with issues of sewage disposal, got quite gruesome actually during the pandemic. And so, yeah, I actually look at in the article, you know, actually I hadn't really thought about this until I was reading, doing research for this article, but you know, some of my family, my ancestors were born in Yellowstone. My father's Yankton Sioux, and I should say that Chuck Sam, his mother is also of Yankton Sioux descent, Dakota descent as well. And he's part of my dad's tribe on that side, but you know, Yanktons are, if you look at the National Park Service site, Yanktons are one of the tribes that are listed as having a claim to the Yellowstone National Park. In his article and on NPR or on PBS News Hour, David Troyer really focuses on the Shoshone-Bannock claims, but there are you know, well over 15 tribes that have claims to Yellowstone, and my dad's tribe is one of them. So I have ancestors who were born within what is now the park, and so because part of the area that my family used to live on was actually in Wyoming, between the Black Hills, mostly the Black Hills and Laramie, but obviously up in the northeast corner of Wyoming as well. And I really sort of had never thought about that before, the fact that my family had this very intimate relationship with that place. I mean, enough so where one of my several great grandmothers actually gave birth there, a couple of them. And you know, when I've gone to Yellowstone in the past, I've never thought about that. I've never thought about, because I always think about it in terms of where our reservations are now. You know, the Shoshone having more of a claim, having reservations right nearby, but not my own family line. And so the article was an opportunity for me to sort of grapple with that, the way in which the boundaries that were set after the Americans came, how it has altered our understanding of our relationship to the landscape and our ancestors' relationship, and imposed sort of boundaries. And I went over this in my previous book, Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears, in the ways that the Four Corners area was established there with boundaries and sort of dividing the claims of tribes up based in these four states, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, states that had not existed in the thousands of years that tribes had, that is our homeland. I'm also Navajo. And so it obliterates. And in fact, one of the tribal leaders I interviewed, she's a Mountain Ute tribal councilwoman. And when she went to speak before the Utah state legislature about bear's ears, she was flat out told by the white legislators that she didn't have a claim because she lived in Colorado, because her tribe had been driven out of bear's ears and their reservation was in now southwestern Colorado. And they do have one community there, still there, White Mesa, which is right where that big uranium mill is. And her children grandchildren live there, and they were just very sneering at her, telling her she had no right to have any voice about what happened in San Juan County, Utah, because her tribe is now in Colorado. We failed to, the institution of America and its boundaries, you know, these counties and states and everything, it doesn't reflect the actual history of the land and our relationship to it. And I should say that the Yankton's also went all the way to the shores of Lake, of the Great Lakes in Minnesota. You know, there are from the 1830s and 1820s, there are watercolors that were painted of Yankton women doing maple sugaring right near the Great Lakes. And so, you know, what my ancestors did, you know, it's a life that's hard for us to imagine or understand, you know, going all the way from Yellowstone and then going to the Great Lakes. My ancestor was born in the Yellowstone area in 1802, so it's quite a while ago. And then my another ancestor born towards the 1850s, she was also born in Yellowstone. But, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, people, anywhere people are listening to this, mostly people in, you know, within reach of our signal, terrestrial signal, that emanates from a tower up in the West Hills of Portland and a couple translators in the gorge and down in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Everybody who listen, but anybody listening, you know, anywhere in the country there's the similar story, similar, you know, hidden, suppressed, marginalized histories that, you know, you yourself are still learning, you know, let alone what, you know, non-native people are, you know, ignorant of in terms of these deep hidden histories. And I just want to, something we may talk about later in the program is this related to this whole issue of land back, which is a very complicated issue. We've talked a fair amount about on this show, but, you know, the Portland Tribune actually just had a couple of really lengthy, interesting articles about the issue of stolen land and land back, including speaking with some Native legal experts on the issue, which brings up a lot of interesting questions. I know, you know, we've talked about the land acknowledgement thing that's also discussed in at least one of the articles as being maybe a first sort of tentative step towards coming to grips with these things. But of course, you know, Oregon itself has a very fraught history of really stealing land originally and through the Termination Act, et cetera. So there's a lot of stuff to deal with there. But I don't know, we can talk more about that later. I wanted to kind of go back to Chuck Sams and who he is. And, you know, some of the more research that you've done. I've got the White House announcement here, so I'll just a few facts about Chuck Sams. He's held a variety of roles with the Confederated Tribes, the Umatilla Indian Reservation, most recently as their executive director. He's also been president and chief executive officer of the Indian Country Conservancy, executive director for the Umatilla Tribal Community Foundation, national director of the Tribal and Native Lands Program for the Trust for Public Land, which is, you know, not the National Park Service, but I'd say adjacent. It certainly is experience in that whole realm of, you know, land conservancy, which is a large field that is, you know, beyond just the parameters of the National Park Service. He's also been executive director for the Columbia Slough Watershed Council, executive director for the Community Energy Project, and president chief executive officer for the Earth Conservation Corps, and he's currently a council member for the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, appointed by Oregon Governor Kate Brown. So he certainly has a wealth of experience in organizations that deal with a lot of the same stuff that the National Park Service. And before I turn it back to you, one last thing I found very interesting. He actually holds a Master's of Legal Studies in Indigenous Peoples Law from the University of Oklahoma.
Yeah, I think when you're, you can see he has, like I said, substantial experience and sort of this looking at traditional Native ways of, you know, particularly of how tribes is as both traditional people and also as political nations with the United States, how they are working actively to manage land in the West, and certainly with the forest, wildfires in the West going on, and the impact of climate change, these traditional practices of management, which were developed and successfully utilized for thousands of years, are getting a second look. And when I was living in Northern California, I was the executive director of the California Indian Basket Weavers Association, and I worked closely with all the different organizations, the state organizations that manage land in the state, and the basket weavers had developed long-standing relationships with these agencies to basically manage basket weaving plants and stuff. And we worked actively with different agencies in burns and controlled burns, prescribed burns, in order to, because the plants that basket weavers use, they require fresh shoots and things to be able to weave with, and this does require burning. And so so we worked with them on that. Now, practices like that are certainly people are comparing the difference. And in some of the fires that we've seen in the West in the past few years, you do see a huge difference between how areas burn that are have already been have been subjected to prescribed burns and thinning versus areas that have not. And these fires can burn very hot where there's a lot of understory and brush and basically sterilize the soil, right? It's not what we want. And so so these sorts of traditional practices are the future of this country. And so.
And speaking of course, there's the sort of huge issue of of land management, which involves the massive resource exploitation of the land, which Native peoples did not engage in, well, because y'all didn't have capitalist profit exploitation and massive industrial transformation of the landscape, which has created so many of the problems we're facing. But the whole issue of that sort of a lot of times missing from the fire debate is a lot of the areas that actually burn most are these heavily managed areas, the tree farms, not the the older forests, which hadn't been logged, actually are much more fire resistant and actually sequester a lot more carbon dioxide. So the whole issue of land management is a vast one, and of course Deb Howland does have the Bureau of Land Management, which is after the Department of Agriculture, which is a separate department which has most of the public land in the West. There's also the Bureau of Land Management.
Land under the Department of Agriculture, and yeah. She doesn't have oversight of that, but the BLM lands and she does. And so I think it's so when I'm looking at so David Troyer had this idea, right? And when he was interviewed on PBS, he basically said that he was kind of pressured by the interviewer, like, well, how would this be implemented? How would national parks be handed over to tribes, how would they have the resources to do this? And he was like, well, I'm an ideas guy. I don't have a plan for implementing it. But, I started looking at it, and I don't mean scare Republicans or people, but there is actually a pathway to accomplish this. And it's not, we won't be able to hand over the entire Park Service. That would be quite difficult because you have to go through Congress to do something like that. But in piecemeal fashion, it is possible. Tribes do run their own national parks. I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, which is the largest tribe in the United States, and apparently has like over 400,000 members now. During the pandemic, another 90,000 people signed up. So it was 370 before the pandemic, so I think it's closer to 450 now. And 450,000 tribal citizens. The but it has a land base the size of Ireland. So it's quite, it's got the population of Iceland, land base of Ireland. It's a country within the United States. And so we have our own national parks, including Monument Valley. Canyon Shea is also managed, it's not one of the national parks, it's managed in conjunction with the National Park Service. And of course, Antelope Canyon, which is really popular with Instagrammers now. And that is a tribal park, a tribal national park. And I was curious how that was funded, not Canyon Shea, which is part of the Park Service, but it turns out, I was talking to a family member who is on the National Resources Committee for the Navajo Nation, and he told me that the tribe doesn't receive any federal funds to manage Monument Valley or Antelope Canyon. The tribe manages these completely independently. And I was a bit surprised about it. I'm trying to make to confirm that. But you know, with Deb Haaland in her position as Interior Secretary, you know, she has the power to, on her own, to approve land into trust applications by tribes. So they can take fee land, which is and turn it into trust land. So describe
once again what trust land is. I know you've gone over this a number of times.
So as I mentioned on this show before, the United States has a really sort of infamous history of not recognizing Native humanity by rejecting the idea that Native nations or Native people can actually own land. And so this is actually the basis of land claims in the United States, which is called the Doctrine of Discovery, which was formulated in its present state by a former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court around 1830, called Chief Justice Marshall, and John Marshall. And so he basically formulated this legal theory that basically Native people don't have the right to own land. And he bases this on a couple of papal bulls, which basically passed by a Medici pope and a couple of pretty scandalous popes. But basically stating that the minute a European Christian discovering nation lands on our shores, then all of the land, the actual fee, the title to the land reverts to the monarch of that country, right? So you have Spain lands, and it all reverts to the Spanish rulers, England, all this stuff. And so so based on this, Chief Justice Marshall then said that this is the basis of the U.S. claims, that they're superior to that of tribal nations, right, that already pre-existed. And so this implies, as I mentioned before, that the U.S. has to be Christian, and it gets its status by being a colony, which is they inherit the status from their colonial country, which would be England, which was under the Pope at that time in the 1500s and early 1400s, and so this is the basis of the idea. This is where the idea of trust land comes. Since tribes are, because we're not Christian and we're not discovering and we're not European, we are legally unable to have title to land, right? So we have to have it held in trust for us by a discovering country, which would be the United States, right? And so this is why we have to go through the United States. So the United States still holds the title. All we get is we get the right to use it as if it was our homeland, which it is. So you can see how this is a quite convoluted, and it's a way in which that a colonial state can completely undercut and sideline the actual rights to the land of the indigenous people it's displacing, right? And also kind of holding hostage. And get complete access to the use of it as you want. And I mean, right now there is a it's funny, when Trump was in charge of the Interior, his guy, he basically issued basically opened up like 28 million acres of public land, BLM lands, to oil leasing and mining and things like that. And that has been suspended by the present director of the Bureau of Land Management under Biden. And so they're actually the Republicans are trying to instigate an ethics investigation of her, claiming that because she had worked for different organizations like the Audubon Society and the Wilderness Society, that she is she can't do these things because her former employers were advocating stopping complete exploitation of these lands. And so I think it shows the sort of tug of war that's occurring, and maybe that turning over the National Park Service to a completely different a group of nations that have completely different perspectives of the land may actually really help in the ways that the institutional effect of colonialism could be diluted and redirected. But I don't think that it's possible at this point politically to do just that, hand over the National Park Service, the entire agency over to a consortium tribe. I don't think that we have the political will or pathway to do that at this point, maybe not for 10 or 20 years, right? But what can happen right now under the present situation would be for tribes to apply to put public lands and even national park lands and monuments into trust, and for Deb Haaland to approve those. And then once that happens, they can do what the Navajo Nation did. The Navajo Nation actually, declared already had these lands in trust, like Monument Valley and Antelope Canyon. And in 1950, the tribal council declared that these were national parks for the Navajo Nation. And they've managed them that way ever since. So it's been going on for 70 years. So once the tribes get these national parks into trust, then they could simply declare them tribal parks. And so that would be quite interesting. I don't know that Haaland has the political will to do this. And this is the way in which I find Democrats so disappointing, because you have Trump, and the minute he gets into office, he's willing to do any crazy old thing that comes into his head. And use his powers however he wants to. With an obvious example being the 85% reduction of Bears Ears, and also the Gran Escalante parks, and at which we are still living with today. Biden's administration has not undone that yet, not restored those parks, I would like to see. I don't know. I mean, I suppose if Deb Haaland did that, and tribes were, actively right now putting together applications to put, chunks of Yellowstone or other national parks, into tribal trust, right? And she just went crazy, approving these while she's in the office. It would be really interesting, I think. Obviously. It would be, and I don't know what kind of political career she would have after she did that, but but it would be interesting. I think it would really change the entire dynamic immediately. Tribes could do it jointly.
Yeah, let me just break in for a second. We're coming up on about 20 minutes left in the program, and I'd like to open up the lines to people calling in with your comments and questions. 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I'm Paul Roland. I'm the regular weekly host of Wednesday Talk Radio. And my second Wednesday co-host, as always, is Jacqueline Keeler, who's a citizen of the Navajo Nation, as she's mentioned, and also of the on her father's side, Yankton Dakota, and so locally based, right, an activist, and been on the show for a number of years now. It's always good to hear your perspective on things. And we're looking for people to call in and engage, 503-231-8187. There's also a KBO Wednesday Talk Radio Facebook page that you can make a comment or question on, if you like it first. And we're talking about a number of things. We're talking about Chuck Sams, the Umatilla tribal member, a leader who has been nominated to head the National Park Service, would be the first Native American to hold that position, and one of the few non-career agency people, which would be also interesting, fresh perspective. We're also talking about some bold proposals to really look at transforming the National Park Service, whether Chuck Sams himself is interested in that is a be an interesting question. If he gets through what will probably be a grueling nomination process. We're also looking at the whole issue of trust land, which is land, quote, held in trust on behalf of Native Americans, which is a sort of a strange legacy of the twisted legal history of colonization and of the indigenous lands of North America. And we're just talking generally about this whole land back issue. So one thing I just was looking up as you were talking, there's a number of different models as well. You're talking about, you know, basically tribes, nations, Native nations that actually have national parks within their boundaries. I think there's some tribes that have some kind of sort of co-management, you know, or at least they're looked on as sort of consultants because they have such deep roots in the lands where those national parks are. There's also, you know, things like the Tsinkiyun, intertribal Tsinkiyun Wilderness Area, which is 4,000 acres of land protected on the Northern California coast, which involve co-management by different the different Native tribes. And I'm sure there's many other examples. So there's, you know, there's the whole issue of land back can take many, many forms, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yes, yeah. The co-management has been a real goal. And although it's been very slow, I'd say, and of course with Bears Ears, notably, you know, the tribes, as I detailed in my book, Edge of Morning, the tribes were the ones that basically came up with the National Monument proposal for Bears Ears. They worked on it for several years, five different tribes working collaboratively and through consensus. And but they have so far been shut out of any management by the Trump administration, and Biden's administration has not come forward yet with a plan to restore the original paradigm of co-management to Bears Ears. And there's been no funding. I interviewed the executive director of the Bears Ears and Tribal Coalition, Pat Gonzalez Rogers, and he was quite outraged because this was not widely reported, but a bill was passed earlier this year that was a giveaway to Energy Fuels, which is the Canadian-based uranium company that actually dictated the reduction of Bears Ears National Monument by 85% under the Trump administration. And I actually reported on this when it happened in December 2017. I wrote an article for High Country News that was republished by Mother Jones and featured on the Samantha Bee Show, Full Frontal, where I looked at, because I knew, having worked on the book Edge of Morning, and I knew that all the areas that were having to do with, you know, sort of energy development had already been removed by the Obama administration. The original proposal for Bears Ears was 1.8 million acres, and Obama's administration cut off, excised about 500,000 acres, which had active oil and gas exploration going on. And so I knew the only thing left within the park itself were uranium, right? Uranium mines, which is not very profitable right now, and there's no reason to develop them. And I found that the state of Utah, the Utah state legislature, had actually issued a 40-page comment during the discussion of the reduction of the park, basically stating that that it was in the best interest of the state of Utah's uranium industry to reduce the size of Bears Ears. And so I kind of put it together, and I was denounced by the CEO of Energy Fuels, but the New York Times did follow-up reporting in January, February of 2018, doing hundreds of FOIA requests, and completely substantiated my reporting. And so now Energy Fuels has managed to get themselves written into a bipartisan bill and got it passed and gotten a $75 million handout from the federal government, while BEARS is itself and the co-management of it has been completely unfunded. It's the only funding that's been coming from private foundations that organizations like the BEARS Intertribal Coalition have worked with. And so it's quite, even now that we're under the Biden administration, the resolution has not been as clear-cut, and folks like Energy Fuels are still benefiting enormously and have the upper hand. And there's been no news coverage of this. The only coverage I could find was, well, Energy Fuels, their press release, they were there just gloating. And it was actually Senator Martin Heinrich, who is a Democrat from New Mexico, who was the co-sponsor of this bill. And I guess New Mexico has a uranium storage site, federal storage site. And so he was looking at that as sort of a way to bring in money for that in New Mexico for his constituency. And of course, Biden's plan does include nuclear power in his climate change plan. And so it's quite concerning. Well, and Bears Ears has this active mine, and then also at White Mesa, the only active uranium mill in the country as well, which has been negatively impacting the Ute Mountain Ute people that live there.
I'd like to just again invite, you only have about 15 minutes left, so if you do want to get your comment or question in, now might be the time to do it, 503-231-8187. I just want to throw just something that popped into my mind talking about, you know, the ongoing difficulty of funding for, you know, these co-management, these, you know, really great projects of co-management that you're talking about. And, you know, probably the National Park Service itself, you said, had millions or billions of dollars of infrastructure backlog. And of course, then there's, you know, the broader question of infrastructure that is being endlessly debated and not very fruitfully at this point. But, you know, I remember, you know, the whole issue of, speaking of land back, when, you know, the American Indian movement was occupying sites, whether it was Alcatraz Island or what was it, Fort Lawton, I think, in Washington State, which became the Daybreak Star Indian Center, or other federal facilities, because there's a, you know, provisions in treaties grant had the would allowed for the granting back to Native tribes disused, vacated federal facilities. So anyway, my bold proposal is, how about, you know, shutting down some of the military bases and turning them over to tribes, and, you know, along with that, you know, the military budget, which is still untouched, you know, taking off a few of these boondoggle big weapon systems. And you know, anyway, that's the problem of funding shouldn't be such a problem. It's just that the fossil fuel industry and the military industrial complex kind of have it all locked up.
Yeah, it really is. And this is why, you know, structural change may be the answer. I mean, as far as changing who manages parks, like trying to change the National Park Service through diversity and equity initiatives has not been successful, right? And so, you know, structural change may be the answer, real absolute structure. And I think that that's actually true for, as I mentioned in my book, Standoff, I think that's true across the board in the United States. What produces this political and cultural standoff in this country is the structure of colonialism, right? And these unrecognized and unacknowledged sort of colonial DNA of so much of the world we live in, from the agencies that run our parks to hiring practices, everything, the whole history, to redlining. That's not just history. It's still actively impacting how we relate to each other in this country. And it's measurable and, you know, in the impacts it has on people of color economically and of white people, you know, the enormous difference in private wealth between white families and black families has been undocumented, and it's just as bad or even worse for Native families. It's measurable, the impacts of this structure, and it's really the structure that needs to change. I'd also like to say that tribes also have as far as protecting lands go, and there's a really great proposal, I should mention that a lot of wilderness advocacy groups have actually addressed to the Secretary Holland to basically begin to use again the power that she has to designate wilderness study areas, which would immediately allow her to put tens of millions of they actually proposed 440 million acres, additional 440 million acres to protect them immediately. Like, just with, you know, she has that power to just do it. Do you know what I mean? And just like she has the power to put lands in the trust for tribes. And so the BLM has already identified over 29 million acres in lower 48 lands with wilderness characteristics that could be immediately protected. But under the Bush administration in 2003, they basically stopped using that power, and no administration since has used that power. And so they're urging them to do that, urging her to do that, to use her power to do that, and in order to help Biden meet his 30 by 30 goal, which is, you know, saving 30% of U.S. lands and waters by the year 2030 to meet the challenges of climate change. And
that would seem like a no-brainer.
Yes, it would be. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I wish that Democrats had, the kind of wherewithal to use the powers when they have them, right? And not just be constantly responding to Republican and right-wing aggression. And also, tribes had a win recently at the beginning of the month. They won a case that basically restored the Clean Water Act in this country. Trump had... greatly narrowed the scope of the Clean Water Act, and threatening our drinking water, wildlife, and rivers, and everything across the country. And so, the six tribes had brought the lawsuit. It was conducted by Earth Justice, and the tribes include the Pascua-Yaqui tribe, the Quinault Indian Nation, the Fond-du-Lac tribe of Lake Superior, Chippewa, the Menominee Indian tribe of Wisconsin, the Hono'odin Nation, and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. And so it has basically restored the Clean Water Act in this country. And then I don't think that gets enough recognition. The standing that tribes have, even as limited as it is quite a force for protecting the rights of all of us.
Well, yeah. I mean, look here in the Northwest. Look at the challenges to the effects of dam building, logging issues, fossil fuel infrastructure. Tribes have played a huge role in that, and I think that could be the subject of a future show. Just that you've talked a lot about, but just the way that you're saying that the use of the existing legal system, as you say, limited as it might be or seem, by the tribes to actually set precedent, good precedents for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, tribes have a legal standing, even with Indian federal law, U.S. constitutional law, that gives them the ability to really press these issues in ways that U.S. citizens individually cannot do. And so they've had some court success doing this. And so and it's been really utilized by the environmental movement, although often unacknowledged. I think that environmental groups can do a much better job of educating their donors and members about the role of sovereignty in fighting for the land.
Mm-hmm. So we have about 6-7 minutes left. Did you get a chance to read those Portland Tribune articles, sort of to bring back a sort of a local? I thought the front page one, there's a lot to talk about, kind of centered on this this young man who's been very involved in the youth climate movement, and is a rapper, a local rapper, and talks about the whole issue of stolen land. And on the inside, there's this really interesting article called "So If the Land's Stolen, Legal Experts Weigh In on What an Elected Body's Mea Culpa Might Mean in Court of Law." They're talking a lot about, you know, the Portland City Council instituted not only a land acknowledgement along with the Multnomah County Commission and other bodies locally, but they've taken some steps towards actually thinking about what that whole issue means to, you know, administrators of land that has, you know, has colonial origins in terms of their administering of it.
Yeah, well, I found the Portland Tribune article very problematic. One, because the people he quotes, not Laura John, of course, but the other people he quotes, like that young man, he's not from Portland. He is, I think, from Colorado. He got involved originally in the fracking issue there as a child. And he doesn't know what his business background is. His mother's white. He started a multi-million-dollar nonprofit around himself, or she did, and it's been very successful. But he doesn't. They don't. I mean, he has no idea what his indigenous connection is. And I think it's in Mexico or the South, not here in the United States, if it exists. He doesn't. He's come forward and said he doesn't know what his indigenous identity is. And then the other one, Nick Martin from the New Republic, he belongs to a tribe that most of the people I've spoken to don't is not a real tribe, and that's been very problematic. And I've been covering that on my issue of pretendianism, and I haven't really dealt with the issue of tribes like that. But yeah, everyone I've spoken to, it's not a real tribe, and so.
But the other article does quote our friend Robert Miller, who's a former Lewis and Clark.
Yeah, he does amazing work, and you know, he's a Shawnee professor, a law professor. He used to teach here at Lewis and Clark, and now he's at ASU in Tempe. But he's written excellent books on the issue of the Doctrine of Discovery, and I think a lot of the things I talk about the Doctrine of Discovery, I am definitely influenced by his lectures and talking to him. I think that when we talk about land back, we have to talk to the actual tribes, not just, you know, people who have positioned themselves to be our spokespeople who have no ties to our lands at all, you know. The sad thing is that a lot of white reporters don't know the difference, right? They can't tell. And this really clouds the issue further and denigrates the efforts of the tribes and marginalizes tribes from their own issues. So,
well, we do have a caller. Sorry to cut you off. I know this is a big subject, and I kind of brought that article up at the last minute. But let's just have Mitch have a quick 30 seconds or a minute for a question or comment. Go ahead, Mitch.
Just very much appreciated your discussion. It's always great hearing Jackie Keeler bring her expertise. I wish she'd have more time. But you guys cited the work she had done and published in High Country News, and I just got my September issue of High Country News, and there's a series of articles on the tribal makeup of the Klamath, Upper Klamath and Klamath Basin region, which of course is playing such a big role in the drought and creating crisis on both sides of the Oregon-California border. So I just want to call attention to these terrific articles in High Country News that just came out, the September edition, and encourage you to keep doing what you guys do.
Well, thank you, Mitch. We only have a couple minutes left, so Jackie,
we talked a lot about
the Klamath.
Yeah, we did a previous show about looking at the Klamath River Basin issue, And certainly because my book Standoff covers the takeover, not only at Standing, you know, the conflict at Standing Rock with the Dakota Access Pipeline, but also takes a look and contrast the Ammon Bundy's takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon, and with the Klamath River Basin issue, he had actually his group, People's Rights, which is a militia group he's been training, an armed militia group he's been training in Idaho during the pandemic. To go and fight for the rights of white farmers in at the Klamath River Basin to water, and that sort of has died down. I understand partly because of all the forest fires. That area is not far from where we had the what's the name of the fire? That really big fire down there. It's So the focus of the community has changed, and so but they have been using well water now to visit Secretary Holland. She cut off the water from the dam there to the farmers there in the valley, and that was causing the conflict and has caused conflict in the past. And two farmers, white farmers, actually purchased land adjacent to where the valve was that controls the water, and were threatening to do what they had done previously. I think in 2011 they had turned off the water. It turned the water back on, the farmers did. But they haven't done the capillary first there, but the water has been drying up. The wells have been drying up that they've been using.
We're out of time. Sorry, that's a huge issue to bring up. High Country News has an article about it. I'll just say one thing, which is the drought isn't going away, and certainly the issue of native historical and possibly, again, native management of that would go a long way towards resolving those issues. But we got to go. Thank you again, Jacqueline Keeler. Really appreciate having you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements